The department is totally focused on the families involved. This is a tragedy for them. It's totally unexpected. This will take us a long time to heal.
The Alaska State Troopers grieve for two of their own. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, smoke jumpers train in Fairbanks for wildfire season.
We know it's dangerous. We know things could happen bad, and when they go bad for us, they generally go really bad. But we try to hope that we can get out of trouble as fast as we can get into it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A 19-year-old Tanana man has been arrested in connection with the murder of two Alaska State Troopers on Thursday. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the bodies of the two slain officers were brought to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage today, accompanied by a trooper escort.
Trooper Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabriel Gabe Rich were in Tanana on Thursday at the request of the village VPSO. They didn't leave the village alive. 19-year-old Nathaniel Lee Kangas has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder in the shooting deaths of the two troopers. Today in Anchorage, a shaken trooper colonel, James Cockrell, said members of the department are still in shock over the killings.
You know, the department is totally focused on the families involved. This is a tragedy for them. It's totally unexpected. And this will take us a long time to heal.
Cockrell described what law enforcement officials know so far about the killings. Johnson and Rich were stationed at the Fairbanks Rural Service Unit and had experience with the villages in their jurisdiction. They were in Tanana Thursday afternoon to serve an arrest warrant on Arvin Morse Kangas, 58, the father of Nathaniel Kangas. The elder Kangas had been involved in an altercation with the village VPSO the previous night and had brandished a shotgun at the village officer while driving by the officer's house. That act prompted VPSO Mark Haglin to call for support.
Troopers arrived in Tanana about 2:45 yesterday afternoon. Troopers made contact with Arvin Kangas near the front door of his residence. While attempting to place Kangas under arrest, a struggle ensued. This resulted in all three entering Kangas' residence. While inside the residence, both troopers were shot and killed by Nathaniel, the son of Arvin.
Cockrell said that events are still being investigated and that he was unsure of who witnessed the crime other than those involved. Cockrell said that after Johnson and Rich were shot, it appears that VPSO Haglin took Nathaniel Kangas in.
We're not totally certain for. We do know that approximately 15 minutes after the shooting, we had a report that the Nathaniel Kangas was in custody in the back of the VPSO patrol vehicle.
Troopers were notified by a phone call at 3:10 Thursday afternoon by the VPSO that there was one trooper dead and another possibly dead. Backup troopers reached the village about 6 Thursday evening. Arvin Kangas turned himself in around 10:30 that night. He and Nathaniel Kangas are now being held in Fairbanks. Cockrell said Friday that Nathaniel Kangas committed the killings with a semi-automatic rifle but would not comment on the number of rounds fired. He said it appears that Johnson and Rich had not fired their guns.
To my knowledge, it doesn't appear so.
Law enforcement officials are preparing charging documents in the case with the help of the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals, Cockrell said. The younger Kangas is being charged with two counts of murder and one count of assault. The elder Kangas is being charged with assault and driving with a revoked license. Investigators remain on scene in Tanana to collect evidence and interview members of the community in regards to the killings of Johnson and Rich. Johnson was 45 years old and had 21 years with the troopers. He leaves behind his wife and three daughters. Rich was 26 and had been on the force for 3 years. He leaves behind his fiancée and their one-year-old child. Separate memorial funds have been set up for the families of both men. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Tanana is an Athabascan village about 130 miles west of Fairbanks, near the confluence of the Tanana and Yukon Rivers. The village's 300 residents all know one another, and many are related. City Mayor Donna Folger says the community is devastated by the shootings.
I think everybody is still in shock. I think everybody is still blown away by what happened.
Folger says residents are already grieving following the death of a local elder. She says a burial was to take place today, but she also wanted to recognize the state troopers.
Honor them going out of our community. It's so sad.
Mayor Folger says she plans to hold a village meeting tomorrow, a chance for local people to come together to pray and support one another. For years, there's been conflict between the Alaska Republican Party's establishment wing and its more conservative Tea Party faction. Those tensions bubbled to the surface today when the party's U.S. Senate candidates took the stage at the state convention. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports from Juneau.
Up until the very end, the Republican Senate candidate forum was mostly a kumbaya. The candidates avoided personal attacks, and they stuck to their message of beating Democratic incumbent Mark Begich. Dan Sullivan, a former attorney general and natural resources commissioner, sprinkled the word unite throughout his speech. He hammered that point when the moderator asked if he would support the party's nominee, even if he lost the primary.
We need to unite. What I've been trying to do for the last 6 months is unite all Republicans.
Mead Treadwell, the sitting lieutenant governor, also promised to support the nominee if Republican voters don't choose him.
We as a party need to stick together.
But then the moderator got to Joe Miller.
I think that when we make such a commitment, it requires a baseline of trust. Both of my opponents are sitting here today, supported Lisa Murkowski in her war on the Republican nominee in 2010. Without that baseline of trust, I cannot make such a commitment.
Miller won the party's Senate primary back in 2010, defeating Murkowski in an upset. While Murkowski had initially said she was going to support the party's choice, she ended up launching a write-in campaign and beating Miller in the general election. Sullivan and Treadwell are seen as more establishment candidates in this Senate race. After the forum, Miller talked to reporters and reiterated that he did not feel comfortable promising to support Sullivan or Treadwell in the event they won the nomination.
We're unwilling to unilaterally disarm and to make a pledge when they supported somebody who looked the Alaskan people in the eye and lied to them about what she was doing. That really questions, in my mind, how trustworthy they are as well. So we're unwilling to make such a pledge.
In April, Politico magazine published a piece by University of Alaska Anchorage professor Forrest Neighbors, suggesting that Miller could run as an independent should he lose the Republican primary. Miller responded in a piece Thursday, saying he has no intention of running as anything but a Republican. The Alaska Senate race is one of the most closely watched races in the country. It's considered a toss-up, with voters split between the Democratic and Republican candidates in the polls. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering former state representative Carl Moses.
When Carl did speak publicly, whether it was in the committee or the rare time that he spoke on the House floor, he generally had something very profound to say.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Firefighters with the Alaska Division of Forestry are responding to a wildfire near Caribou Lake today. Forestry spokesman Darren Finley says the fire was called in at around 2 p.m. and has burned about 10 acres, 4 miles southwest of Caribou Lake. Caribou Lake is on the southern Kenai Peninsula, about 25 miles northeast of Homer. Finley says two helicopters are on scene and an additional crew has been called in from Palmer. He says as of 2:30 p.m. today, the fire was 50% contained, and he is hopeful the fire is under control. West Anchorage Republican Lindsey Holmes will not be running for re-election to the Alaska House of Representatives. Holmes has served 8 years in the legislature, six of them as a Democrat. She switched parties after her last election and then became the target of a recall campaign. She says that while the criticism was difficult, that's not her primary motive for leaving office.
I never went into this planning to be somebody who was down there forever. And after 8 years, I came home and I just wanted to be home more.
Holmes confirmed she is retiring from politics the same day the Anchorage Superior Court handed down a decision related to her recall. Judge Gregory Miller upheld a ruling by the Division of Elections that there were not sufficient grounds for a recall against Holmes. The judge also rejected the argument that the statutes governing recalls were overly burdensome. Weegee Tazi is the West Anchorage District Chair for the Democratic Party, and he argued the case for the recall campaign. He says they will not be appealing the decision now that Holmes is retiring.
The voters stood up, and for 2 years, essentially 2 years, for an entire term, made it very clear that they were unhappy and that they weren't gonna put up with that. And if you want to find out if your district has a mandate, then you should run again. And she's not running.
Matt Klayman, a former Anchorage assemblyman, will be running for the West Anchorage House seat as a Democrat. There are no Republicans in the race yet. Flags are at half staff today as Alaska says goodbye to its longest-serving state representative. Carl Moses died in Sand Point on Wednesday after a long illness. He was 84. As KUCB's Andy Ropeek reports, he leaves a legacy of service in Southwest Alaska and across the state.
Most people who knew Carl Moses will tell you he was a man of few words.
But when he spoke, even I listened.
That's Moses' wife of 23 years, Larissa. She says that as a business owner and statesman, her husband was devoted to making the Aleutian Islands and Alaska a better place. Moses grew up on Sanak Island near Sand Point. He opened his first store there when he was young and went on to run stores in False Pass and King Cove, where he was a member of city council. He was first elected to the state legislature in 1964. 2 years later, he settled in Unalaska, where he'd stay for 4 decades, fishing and running businesses. Former Unalaska Mayor Frank Kelty says from the start, Moses helped put the town on the map.
I always felt that Carl had a good feeling that fisheries was going to develop here.
Moses's general store in Unalaska was Carl's Commercial, which became a gathering place and a supplier for fishing vessels as the town grew. He later opened a hotel, a bar, and briefly a steakhouse. Shirley Marcourt is Unalaska's current mayor. She says Moses liked contributing to unfinished places.
Certainly business-wise, but then it turned into, for being a statesman, how could he help the community grow?
Moses was one of just a few early legislators to prioritize fisheries. He won elections as a Republican and a Democrat. He left the House in 1973 and took what he once called a 20-year vacation in an interview with KUCB. He built his businesses and served on the State Board of Fish and as president of the Aleut Corporation. In 1992, a year after he married Larissa, Moses' friends urged him to return to the House. He ran as an independent and won. Moses served 11 terms total, more than any other representative, and he did it as a member of all three major political parties.
He often joked that, by golly, maybe he'd have to run as a Green Party candidate just to round it all out.
That's Representative Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat who was part of Moses' staff. He wanted to run for office after Moses retired, but his time came sooner than he'd hoped. Edgman opposed Moses for his seat in 2006. The tied election was famously decided by a coin toss, which Edgman won.
You know, I look back at that occasion with very bittersweet memories because I never wanted it to be Carl that I was running against.
Edgman says Moses was one of Alaska's greatest Native leaders. He says Moses taught him a lot about politics, how to be patient, and how to pick your moments.
You know, when Carl did speak publicly, whether it was in the committee or the rare times that he spoke in the House floor, he generally had something very profound to say and memorable as well.
Unalaska City Manager Chris Laddick remembered Moses with his poker face and his trademark pipe, waiting in his office for plans to come together.
He'd always be the vote that someone would need at the last minute, and 15 minutes before midnight, they'd go, Carl? And he had a little piece of paper with his projects written on it, and he says, time to go.
Moses was the architect of the state's Shared Fisheries Resource Landing Tax, which brought millions from offshore processors back to coastal communities. And he was a champion of capital projects in his district. Those included Sand Points Harbor and a small boat harbor in Unalaska that was named for him when it opened in 2011. Moses left a mark. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she admired him when she was in the statehouse.
He gave a full career to representing people, not only in the legislature, but at other levels. And you don't forget that.
When Moses left the House, he told his wife, Larissa, it was time to move away from Unalaska. He wanted to settle somewhere he could return to his roots.
And I said, okay, where are we moving to? And he said, Sandpoint. I want you to come and look. So we come to Sandpoint, and he took me on these steps, and he says, what do you think of a store right here? And I'm like, okay, we're actually moving here. And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, I guess my job is to make home. And from 2006 to now, we've made Sandpoint our home.
Moses died at that home on Wednesday. Larissa says he wanted his ashes scattered on Sanak. She plans to hold memorial services in Sandpoint and Anchorage, along with Moses' two children, Lewis and Arlene, and other friends and family. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The state legislature has boosted money for education, but it's not enough to stem cuts by the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. The district is getting $6 million new dollars from the state, $3.3 million more than the expected increase. But Acting Superintendent Karen Gaborik says it's not sufficient to avert teacher and staff reductions.
If we were to restore 28.4 teaching positions, two counselors, and 2.4 library assistants, we would be at about a $1.3 million shortfall.
Gaborik says that doesn't include an additional operational funding deficit. District Chief Financial Officer Mike Fisher says part of the reason for the shortfalls is a legislative directive regarding support for charter schools.
They said you need to provide more funding to your charter schools, so we have to allocate funding to charter schools, about $1.3 million.
The district is asking the Borough Assembly to help cover its deficit. The education bill passed by the legislature includes 3 years of funding increases, but the district is still anticipating deficits in coming years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Shady Grove Oliver. This week on AK, smoke jumpers. Red flag warnings have already been issued for parts of South Central and the interior, and wildland firefighters are gearing up for the season. Some of them will approach wildfires from the ground, but there's one elite group that's been training for more than 2 months to fight fire from the air. KUAC's Emily Schwing caught up with the Alaska Smoke Jumpers to find out how they train and why they do it.
A three-story metal tower with a zipline stands at the end of a small field in Fairbanks.
A group of the most elite wildland firefighters in the nation climbs to the top.
First jumper, get in the door.
The jumper's only about 50 feet off the ground, but the exercise he's taking part in simulates what it's like to stand at the open door of an airplane 3,000 feet above the ground. It's the same kind of scenario smoke jumpers will face if there's a real wildfire.
Get ready.
This firefighter takes off across the zip line.
Jump 1,000, look 1,000, reach 1,000, wait 1,000, pull 1,000.
That's Lisa Allen. She watches from across the field. She spent the last 18 years fighting wildfire all over the western United States. Like most smoke jumpers, she started on the ground before she took to the skies.
It's a very efficient way to get to a fire. I love being in the sky. I love flying. I wouldn't say I'm an adrenaline junkie, but I do like the thrill of it and just the independence of it.
Hurling oneself from a moving aircraft into a blazing inferno might seem like something that comes with a long list of potential dangers. But Allen says there are really only a handful of things that can go wrong.
They're very rare. They rarely ever happen. But if you don't handle them correctly, they can have very serious consequences.
Smoke jumpers train to fight wildfires that can't be reached from the ground. These are blazes that flare up far from road systems and in some of the most remote parts of the country. What smoke jumpers do is different from their land-going counterparts, who train to contain fire by approaching it from its outside edges. Training for smoke jumpers is rigorous, and it requires more than just firefighting skills. Robert Yeager is the crew supervisor for the Alaska Smoke Jumpers. He thinks the fitness test is the most nerve-wracking part.
We have to do a PT test every year, and it's not that hard. It's just somebody is timing you, and it's for your job. So it's pass or fail. If you don't pass, you don't have a job.
They have to run a mile and a half under 9 minutes and 30 seconds, or 3 miles in 22 minutes and 30 seconds. They also have to do 10 pull-ups, 60 sit-ups, and 35 push-ups. Yeager's been jumping for 24 years, and he hasn't failed yet.
It's always close. Even if you get it easy, it's still hard.
Maybe the hardest test involves packing 110 pounds for 3 miles in less than 90 minutes. Kevlar jumpsuits the smoke jumpers wear, combined with all the gear they carry in the field, can weigh even more than that. They train as much as they do, in part because they also have to be ready at a moment's notice. Lisa Allen says when they are called to a fire, they don't have much time to grab all that gear and get on an airplane.
So you have 2 minutes from the time the siren goes off to the time you need to be on the plane, because they want to be rolling out of here in 4 minutes and then wheels up flying in 6 minutes.
But even with all the preparation, there are still stories of close calls. Operations Supervisor Rob Allen has been jumping since the early 1990s. He says it's about knowing his gear, understanding the risk, and trusting his fellow jumpers.
We know it's dangerous. We know things could happen bad, and when they go bad for us, they generally go really bad. But we try to hope that with our training, you know, the way we communicate with each other and we pay attention to stuff, that we can get out of trouble as fast as we can get into it.
Back on the zip line, a jumper works through a simulated parachute malfunction. Lisa Allen says the slow, methodical count helps him keep a time frame.
In stressful situations, you can become unaware really quickly of time passing. And in that situation, time is of the essence. So you want to stay in a very sequenced count to get a canopy up above you that's going to save your life.
The smoke jumping base in Fairbanks is one of 9 run by the federal government in the nation. In all, roughly 400 smoke jumpers are training to fight fires this year. 64 of them are here in Alaska. I'm Emily Schwing for AK.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Wrangell, a small island fishing community in southeast Alaska that is the only town in the state to have been governed by 4 distinct groups: Tlingit, Russian, British, and American.
I am Carol Westmore. I live in Wrangell, Alaska, and I work for the city and borough of Wrangell, and I've been living here for about 20 years. We are an island just across from the mainland, and that's situated at the mouth of the Stikine River, which is a massive river. It's one of the, it's like the fastest navigable river in North America. So all the islands surrounding us are mountainous. We're in the heart of the Tongass National Forest. So the city itself is a very small area surrounded by the national forest. Very green, it's in a temperate rainforest. Our primary sort of economic drivers include commercial fishing and processing, as well as tourism. Then we have timber harvesting and processing used to be one of our mainstays, and it's much smaller these days just because of the national political climate with the timber harvesting in the Tongass. One of the growing sectors within our community is marine service industry, meaning we have a 150 and 300 ton boat haul out, and so we have a large sector that work on boats. From May until September, you know, with the light being, you know, the long hours and the fishing starting and the summer season, I mean, it's just go, go, go. I mean, people will be going 12-hour days easy. There's a lot of outdoor recreational opportunities, from kayaking and fishing and hiking and sightseeing and wildlife viewing. I mean, so there's lots for people to do, and the residents partake in all that. During winter, we'll have several really good snowfalls that will stay, and the snow machines come out, and people are out over the island snow machining and enjoying the time in the snow. It's very safe. The community really looks out for its kids and tries to take care of its kids. And, you know, that's what's kept us here. We don't need the big city. We really have maintained sort of that real Alaska small town feel. And I think a lot of visitors that come to Wrangell really enjoy that aspect of it.
Carol Rushmore works for the city and borough of Wrangell. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community on the segment, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Schwing, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Feit, and Monica Goki. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.